ready for another space adventure with Andrew Rennie and The Space Show.
Right now is The Space Show. Welcome to The Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. And please get your diary handy. On this evening's The Space Show, we take a reality check on over-optimistic ideas on living in space and on the moon. Author Christopher Wanjek spoke on Monday night to the Space Association of Australia about getting into space and settling on the moon and using its resources. Now, you might want to note down this number: 90886466. We begin our show with Paul Gilbert. Now, the moon has no atmosphere, but Paul has a vision for an atmosphere on the moon. And that's one wacky idea that Wanjek will dismiss.
I'm so fed up with things, I wanna pack my bags and leave. Leave the whole world behind, ain't coming back anytime soon. But where am I supposed to go when there ain't no air to breathe? And no one to talk to on the moon. And fabricate an atmosphere on the moon. Now you may wonder and you may ask, why is it that I want to steal all the fun away from the younger generation? Well, you know I would do it all myself, because it sounds like fun to me. But I just don't seem to have the imagination. So I'm asking all the children to quit wasting time with music that's been so auto-tuned, and stand on the shoulders of Galilee to learn how to fly up and fabricate an atmosphere on the moon. With an atmosphere, we could have the rain and flowers grow. With an atmosphere, sun on the bright side, dark side of the snow. With an atmosphere, so much of land spreading far and wide. With an atmosphere, we'll make an ocean, an earth can bring the tide. We'll be right back.
trouble when we have everything that we need right here? Why not just stop fighting each other and live here in peace? Well, we've been trying and trying and trying for so many thousand years, but nothing seems to work, so I'm gonna live on a great big piece of cheese.
So I'm asking all the children to quit wasting time with music that's been so auto-tuned, and stand on the shoulders of Galilee to learn how to fly up and fabricate an atmosphere on the moon. So I'm asking all the children to quit wasting time with music that's been so auto-tuned, and stand on the shoulders of Galilee to learn how to fly up and fabricate an atmosphere.
Paul Gilbert, trying to fabricate an atmosphere on the moon. Well, here is Space Association President Peter Arwood to introduce this evening's guest.
Christopher Wanjek. Christopher he received a bachelor's degree in journalism from Temple University and a master's degree from Harvard School of Public Health. He's an author of several books, Bad Medicine, Misconceptions and Misuses Revealed, from Distance Healing to Vitamin O, and Food at Work, Workplace Solutions for Malnutrition, Obesity and Chronic Obesity and Chronic Diseases. And these books, particularly about the second one I mentioned there, has got very high reviews, and it's a well-respected piece of writing. And it basically has kicked off some projects inspired by government legislation, Mexico, Lithuania, Uruguay and South America. As an astronomy writer, Chris worked at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland until 2007, and he freelanced. He's currently the armchair astrophysics columnist for the Astronomical Society of the Pacific's Mercury magazine. As a health writer, he wrote stories for CBS Health Watch, The Washington Post, a weekly column in Live Science called Bad Medicine. And while a student at Temple University, he was part of a comedy scene and produced different comics, and he also had a stint writing for Jay Leno from 1998. Chris's book he's here to speak with us tonight is called Spacefarers: How Humans Will Settle the Moon, Mars and Beyond. It's available it's published through Harvard University Press. It's got really good reviews, including from yours truly. I read it and I loved it. It was fantastic. So this review from Skeptic magazine, the best book on space exploration since Isaac Asimov. So that was Michael Schremer. And he's joining us now live from the US, if he's still there.
But I wanted to say something briefly about the book, my book, Spacefarers. My idea is I wanted to present, you know, what was possible, what was probable in space, what we're probably going to do. Lots about what's possible. And let's face it, we could live on, you know, any planet or moon in the solar system. That's all possible. We could do that today. But there's no economic or emotional motivation to be in every single place in the solar system. I mean, think about your own experiences in Australia, me in America, our ancestors, maybe you yourself migrated to this destination, you know, mostly for economic and emotional reasons. You didn't go to Australia, or they didn't go to Australia, just because someone invented a boat, you know, and likewise, you know, we could get to the top of Mount Everest now. Lots of people are climbing up there, but no one's living up there, you know, despite the beautiful view. No one lives on Mount Everest because it's just not practical. You know, what do you do for a living? You know, what are your kids going to do? And the solar system is a lot like that, isn't it? There's some spectacular views out there, but are we really going to live out there, colonize it, settle it? What are you going to do for a living? You know, what are your kids going to do? Can even grow up in such an environment? So that's what I was trying to elicit in this book. And that said, yeah, I do think we're going to be on the moon in something looking like this in 10 or 15 years. I think we're going to be on Mars in about 15 or 20 years in something simple like this. Will we be in orbiting cities with artificial gravity and low Earth orbit? Well, you know, maybe by the end of this century, because I do think there are economic and emotional motivations to get us to that point. But before we do, in the decades to come, we're going to immensely increase our presence in low Earth orbit with a stepping stone towards this, with like space hotels and space factories, space resorts. That's the natural progression to something like this. And I even think we're going to get to Venus somehow. This is the atmosphere of Venus. It's a proposed NASA mission to be in the clouds above Venus. You may have heard that we discovered the phosphine in the atmosphere, and that's a possible biological signal of life there. It's very speculative. The phosphine is real, but you know whether it's from life, who knows? But we should send a probe and just you know learn more. And if there's life on Venus, by all means, we could go there and live in surprising comfort above the Hellas surface. And we're going to drive there. That's how we're going to get there. Okay, so this obviously is in jest, but this is an actual picture you might know of the Tesla automobile launched by SpaceX, driven by a mannequin on its way to Mars. A fascinating picture, but I think it's very symbolic too for me of what I think SpaceX and other companies, their role is in driving our exploration of the universe. They're going to help make this possible. But before I talk about what I think we're going to do out there, I think we should talk about why we're going to do it. Because I think there's a basic misconception from my point of view. Our message doesn't necessarily endear others to our movement to do more in space, because it's a bit pessimistic. It's this idea of leaving the Earth because something's going to happen here. Even Stephen Hawking has said that. We have to clear out of this place in 100 years because we need to be a multi-planet species, right? We need to be on the moon and Mars in case something terrible happens on Earth. But I mean, that's so illogical to me because I can't think of anything really that would happen to the Earth that would make it less pleasant to live on than any place else in the solar system, Mars included. I mean, look at these are the ideas that people put out there. Population overload. Well, that's the opposite of extinction, isn't it? With too many people. But I don't think there's too many people on Earth. The problem is there's just too much inefficiency. I mean, we waste half our food. We waste 10 to 50% of our electricity on these leaky energy grids. You know, all the methane we don't capture, all the fertilizer that we don't use properly, let it run into the ocean. There's incredible efficiencies that we could have to have billions more people on Earth. And I actually think that's a good idea because more people mean more ideas, more entrepreneurs, more inventors. I'm all pro people. And we can do that with space resources helping us. The pandemic, of course, that's horrible. We're in one now. I personally know two people who have died from COVID-19. But no virus has ever wiped out human beings before. So why would this happen now in the era of DNA sequencing and vaccines? It doesn't make any sense. No virus can kill every single person. Nuclear war, asteroid strikes are kind of the same thing, aren't they? You know, there's some horrible bombardment. I think it's a very real risk. It's slight, but real. But again, in terms of wiping out the human race, billions of people might die, absolutely. But hundreds of thousands will survive. You know, civilization will be set back by a couple hundred years. I'm not advocating for this, but there's going to be people surviving in well-fortified underground bunkers. Let's face it, these nuts that we don't like, who knows what the next generation is going to be. But also people, you know, living in caves, you know, eating canned beans that they stole from the supermarket that got abandoned. You know, there's going to be people who survive such a scenario. And here's the illogic of it all. You know, we're smarter than the dinosaurs. If we were living on Mars in some independent way, we would have the space technology to do so. We would have the space technology to push an asteroid aside. We would be able to I mean, we would probably jump on the thing and start mining it, teaching it a lesson. We could easily deflect an asteroid if we were already on Mars. And likewise with climate change, which I actually do think is the greatest threat to life, all life on Earth right now. And it's going to get worse before it gets better. But there's engineering solutions coming down the line. That said, the same ill logic that if we were living on, if we had the technology to be on Mars, we would be living in these mini Earths. And if we could do that on Mars, we would do that on Earth, right? You know, if we could terraform Mars, we would terraform Earth back to Earth if we made it so horrible here. So these aren't threats. This is actually the only threat that I could think of. Some alien race coming in and vaporizing the Earth, right, for an intergalactic superhighway. There's no solution to that one. You just have to cross your fingers that that one doesn't happen. This is the message I think we should be sending out there to get other people involved in space and to share our excitement. We're doing this not to escape Earth, but to make it better. And we're already started that, right, with these communication satellites and weather satellites. That has, you know, increased the prospects of life for so many people. It's made life so much better for so many people. And we're just wanting to continue that. You know, with space technology, we could be putting our energy production out in space with solar panels in low Earth orbit. We could do fusion or fission on the moon. We could put computers in low Earth orbit where they'd be incredibly more efficient at 40 Kelvin or even 4 Kelvin. That's where they want to operate. We could do the worst possible kinds of mining, the most polluting kind, get that on the moon where there is no life to worry about. And finally, build these, you know, the microgravity factories that we've long wanted to build these interesting molecules and semiconductors. We can start doing that for the betterment of mankind. And then, you know, the fun stuff, the lunar tourism and such, maybe go to the moon and Mars. That, in my mind, is secondary to what we're really after about improving life on Earth by venturing out into space.
Speaking via Zoom from the United States to the Space Association of Australia meeting, virtual meeting, of course, on Monday, just 2 days ago, that's Christopher Wonjek. He's the author of the book Spacefarers, and he has some definite ideas on why only about 500 people or less have been into space, and that is that getting off the Earth is terribly difficult, and very, very expensive.
And of course, the hardest thing is getting off this rock, right? That first 100 kilometers is a doozy. Once you're up there, then we're good to go. In rockets, as you know, are just terribly inefficient. It's the only way up there right now. But when you look at a rocket, that is 95% metal and fuel, right? You know, it's only about 2-5% payload, and that's rather inefficient. That's why these things are so expensive. And the prices have been coming down with the likes of, you know, Elon Musk and even Rocket Lab over in New Zealand. The price is now down to about $2,000 per kilogram, you know, depending on how you measure it. But that's about a factor of 10 down from where it was about two decades ago. And that's remarkable progress. Imagine if they could keep on doing that just with market efficiencies and get it down another factor of 10 to maybe a couple $100 per kilogram. That's like a cost of an overnight package, isn't it, from Australia to the States. But then we have to go a little bit beyond that, and because there's only so much, so far we could get with these market efficiencies. But there's possibly new rocket fuels out there. The most promising I've seen is metallic hydrogen, which was created at Harvard University, thought to exist in the core of Jupiter. I mean, very hard to actually produce. But if they could ramp up production and, more importantly, store it safely, this would have a tremendous kick, several orders of magnitude better than any rocket fuel. And we could get the price of rockets, the cargo, probably down to tens of dollars per kilogram. So even more and more things could get into space step by step. And then beyond that, I think we just have to get, we have to get away from rockets eventually, right? We can't have tens of thousands of people going into space every day by relying on all these rockets. I mean, the noise would just be crazy if you think about it that way. We're going to have to find a new highway into space, essentially. Lots of people talk about the space elevator, which I think is cool as all hell, right? I mean, it's a fascinating idea. We could do it on the moon and Mars. I think it would work there. I just don't think it's practical for Earth. not for the technical reasons. You know, of course, this is a cable stretching from Earth out to geosynchronous orbit. That's 36,000 kilometers away, held taut by a counterweight at the top going around the Earth. But there's no cable strong enough to hold that tension, right? It would just snap in half. But even if there were, and there could be technology coming along in 10 or 15 years, I don't doubt that. It's the practical aspects of this. Where do you put it? Because you have to protect it from terrorism, right? You know, you're going to have some nut wanting to drive an airplane into it and bring the whole thing down. That would be horrible. I mean, this thing would wrap around the whole Earth when it comes down. I mean, that would just be, you know, mind-blowing destruction. And then worse yet, more menacing is the, you know, the all the space junk in low Earth orbit that's going to be constantly hitting this thing and destabilizing the whole cable. It really just isn't practical, unfortunately. But there's better ideas and actually more practical and cheaper ideas. One fascinating idea is the Skyhook, literally a hook dangling from the sky. You could have many of these things. They're, you know, they're in orbit, but touching into the upper atmosphere. You could reach that with a sounding rocket or even a high altitude balloon or airplane. You get your cargo attached to it and flip it up into space. We could do this now with modern technology. It's a matter of putting investment into it. Same as orbiting rings and orbital rings, which is a bit mind-blowing, but actually simpler than the space elevator. It's exactly what it sounds like. This will be a ring around the whole planet. And I just mentioned the space junk. We already have, in many ways, a ring around our planet, don't we? But if you could have coordinated space junk, right? If you have these, you know, metal rings that you just launch into orbit and then start fusing together until it reaches around the entire planet, okay? And so conceptually, it's easy enough to do. And then you send an electric current through it and magnetize it. So now it becomes like a maglev train. You know, this thing is like moving at 10 kilometers per second. It's in orbital speed, okay? And it's actually like a maglev train in reverse where the rails are moving. But then you could levitate a platform above there, many platforms. They would be stationary. And you could be up on that platform. And at that point, you're not in orbit. You're just at orbital height, but not orbital velocity. You could just pull up cargo from the Earth at that point, pull up people. You could have platforms up there for space planes that never touched Earth that just take off to the moon or take off to our hotels out there. Of course, this would cost trillions of dollars to build, even with the lower space costs. But that's what countries do, don't they? They invest in railroads. They invest in highway systems. At some point, it's going to make sense when you have enough commerce out there that this is going to be the practical way to go. You know, the U.S. interstate highway system in the United States costs $500 billion to build, an incredible fee. But the investment is paid off 6-1 in terms of the commerce that has enabled. Once Chicago wanted to start talking to Houston, you know, wanted to travel back and forth, that highway started making sense. And eventually, this is going to make sense. We're going to get away from rockets and do something like this way down the line. But this is where we need to be going.
From the United States, author Christopher Wonjick, author of the book Space Bearers. And we have more of his ideas after these messages.
Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
You're listening to The Space Show, and our guest this evening is Christopher Wonjick. Having described how we might make it cheaper to get off the Earth, the question now becomes, well, what will we do when we get there? He has some ideas on that.
In order to grow our presence in space, so a bit... There's only three people up here right now, the International Space Station. And, you know, it's a bit sacrilegious in many circles to say that I'm not a big fan of the International Space Station. When you think that this thing costs $150 billion to build and only 220 some people have visited it. You know, we're spending $500 million per person to get somebody up there. That's really not sustainable. But I do think, you know, really interesting things are popping up, so to speak. This is an inflatable habitat that Robert Bigelow, Bigelow Aerospace, put on, attached to the International Space Station. And They did this in 2016. It's still there being used as storage, holding up incredibly well. Here's Bigelow down here at the bottom. I can't quite point to it here. And he has bigger ideas. These are the B330s. The 330 stands for 330 cubic meters of volume, which is more volume than the livable area, livable volume on the International Space Station. He can build and launch these things for less than 1/100th of the cost of the ISS. And this is what's coming this decade. Imagine these things as, you know, factories in space or laboratories in space or hotels in space. That's what Bigelow wants to do with the hotel. He's in a hotel business. He's a billionaire that made his money in hotels. He wants to launch these things, invite people up there to spend a week or two. And of course, only the ultra rich are going to be able to do it at first. But even Tom Cruise, who wants to film the next Mission Impossible movie in one of these things mid-decade. This is where we're going next with low Earth orbit. It's a very easy way to get more activity into low Earth orbit. You could have your assembly line in there, microgravity assembly line. You don't have to worry about some expensive ISS type unit. Okay, so eventually we'll get to the moon. The reason why our space science program has been so successful, getting things to Mars, getting things to Saturn, is because the presidents don't decide, oh, I want an infrared telescope. And then the next president comes in, no, I don't like infrared. I want to go ultraviolet. That discussion never happens. That discussion is left to peer review, as it should be. So the presidents only come in with more or less bad ideas, and NASA makes them worse. And this idea of going in 2024 is detrimental to our efforts to have permanency on the moon, because we don't want to go for pride. That's a waste of money. We want to set up infrastructure first so that we can eventually get there the right way. So I'm hoping this idea goes away. But again, it's just a lot of money spent and goes away. Then a new idea comes in and you spend money. So we can talk more about that. I do have obviously strong opinions in the question and answer. I can talk more. But what's interesting, I think, about the moon is that it's going to be a lot like Antarctica. We have this whole model set up with Antarctica. We have science bases down there, you know, run by countries. Australia is down there. And we have scientists who go for just a couple months per year when the weather permits. And you have some rugged group that can stay around year round. But no one lives on Antarctica. No one owns Antarctica. Probably going to be the same for the moon. No one's going to live there or own it, right? But they could visit it there. And most very interesting to me is that, well, actually, the easiest place to go is the South Pole on the moon. And that's because the moon doesn't have a tilt. So it's getting relatively constant sunshine 80% of the time. And because of that, there's a constant temperature of about a minus 50 Celsius, which is cold but manageable. As you might know, on, you know, anywhere else, like on the equators, there's this day-night cycle you have to contend with, where during the day, which lasts 2 weeks long, it gets up to 130 degrees Celsius. And then at night, without the sun for 2 weeks, it gets down to about a minus 170 degrees Celsius. I mean, so that's not fit for man or beast or machines for that matter. I mean, you can't do much there. The Apollo astronauts had to go a few days during the dawn or the dusk where the temperature was just right. But on the moon, you have that constant temperature. And in some of these craters here, you have, actually, they're high enough that there's perpetual sunlight. So you constant solar energy up there. And it's also cool that down in these shadowed craters, they never get any sunlight. And there's ice deposits there that you can collect. And you can obviously melt the ice to drink or use for human biology. But also, this is just mind-blowing to me, the ice is essentially rocket fuel. Ice is H2O. In rocket fuel is hydrogen and oxygen. That's the propellant. So there are billions of dollars worth of rocket propellant in these ice craters that we could use to propel ourselves back to Earth or deeper into the solar system. I just think that's a neat idea. So I do think we can be sustainable on the moon without the profit, just from government activities, again, with that Antarctica model. Right now in the U.S., the National Science Foundation is what supports the Antarctic program at about $500 million a year. Meanwhile, NASA is spending $4 billion a year just to support the International Space Station. And there, it's very controversial right now. You saw that flip between the Democrats and the Republicans. And well, the Republicans don't have much of a stance on the ISS, but there's this idea of decommissioning it in 2025 to stop NASA funding, at least for the U.S. portion, because it is international. And I do actually think that's a fine idea, because I think at this point we should just hand it over to commercial enterprises now that our governments have done so well in teaching us how to live and work in space. Let the commercial enterprises go in at this point, make the moon sort of like the new ISS. Use that $4 billion in the NASA budget to set up a foundation of learning on the moon so we can learn how to live on the moon, how to work on the moon. And that's because that's speculative right now of what kind of money can be made on the moon. There's lots of talk about mining, which is practical if there's a market, of course. You know, you got all this iron and silicon and aluminum, and it's just, you just have to scoop it up on the surface. But that only works if you have something to use those minerals for. If we're building massive structures in space, that's the perfect place to get them, on the moon. We don't need them on the Earth. But until we're at that point where we're building structures, the mining isn't that profitable of a concept that there would be investors willing to invest in this. Likewise, with some other speculative ideas about rare earth elements on the moon, they're in great supply there, but they're actually, there's a lot of them on the Earth. Australia has large deposits of the rare earths. These are very valuable in that in any given iPhone uses all 17 rare earth elements. United States has deposits. We choose not to mine them because they're very polluting. But China has 80% of the market right now because they're at this point in their development where they care less about the environment and more about building their economy. So unless there was some major effort to stop polluting the earth, which unfortunately, I don't know if that's going to happen anytime soon, mining these kind of things on the moon just doesn't make any sense right now.
Speaking to the Space Association of Australia via Zoom was Christopher Wanjik, and we have more from him. There was an opportunity to ask him questions, and that issue of mining on the moon was taken up by one questioner.
Oh, how will mining leases on the moon, well, how will mining leases be governed, do you think?
Yeah, that's a... That's a tricky question. It depends how people are interpreting the space treaty. There is a space treaty and there is something called a moon treaty. The space treaty was the original one. And that's a bit like Antarctica, that no one can own the moon. The moon treaty is trying to go a step further, that anything you, it's only, the moon treaty has only been signed by countries who don't have space programs right now. That moon treaty is stating that anything we take from the moon, any profits have to be spread out across the whole globe because it's for everyone, not for any given nation. The space treaty has some wiggle room. And right now, you can't own it, but you can't own any land, but that doesn't mean you can't take any resources from it. And the Obama administration actually did create something in, I think, 2015, that would enable you to profit from materials on the moon and asteroids. And I thought that was curious about asteroids where, yes, you might not be able to own that asteroid, but you can mine every last crumb of it until it's completely gone and profit from that, but never own it. But there's going to be some discussions in world courts about the rights of who has the right to be where on the moon. It's a big planet, but there are places that are better than others. Remember those craters I spoke about, the top of craters where there has perpetual sunlight? That's valuable real estate. Whoever gets there first is going to get that. And whoever gets there second is going to get a less opportunistic place to put their solar panels. Mm. So I don't know how that's going to be worked out. No one does. When this law was created, this treaty was signed, there wasn't really much talk about it, but it has to be discussed now. Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure.
We have more from Christopher coming up shortly. Christopher worked at the Goddard Space Flight Center for a time, and there's a group of scientists and engineers there who formed a musical group called the Chromatics, and they have this song, which is simply called Lunar Love.
My love's a quarter million miles away, and she's 7,000 miles around. When I'm walking on her surface, gravity's one-sixth of normal, so my feet don't hardly touch the ground. From her Mars to her uplands, from her basins to her craters, she's the shining sphere that dominates my dreams. We're orbiting together round our center of attraction. Now my days and nights are coming up, moonbeams. What goes around comes around, you know it. Don't tell me that my love is just a phase. You may think we're on the wane, but time will show it. We go from new to full to new in only 29 days. There's a craziness about our strange attraction. There's a side to you that I don't ever see. But your tidal forces keep my ecosystems running high. Let me shelter in your sea of tranquility. Let me shelter in your shining lunar sea. I'm not the only man this side of Mars to get my heart so dazzled by your charms. You've been the guiding light to many sailors and astronomers, but none of them has held you in his arms. Don't talk to me about our little difference in ages. What's a mere 4.6 billion years? They say you have no core, nothing solid at your center, and a lack of atmosphere just makes a girl so insincere. What goes around comes around, you know it. Don't tell me that our love is just a phase. You may think we're on the wane, but time will show it. We go from full to new to full in only 29 days. There's a craziness about our strange attraction. There's a darker side to you that I don't see. But your tidal forces keep my ecosystems running high. Let me shelter in your sea of tranquility. Let me shelter in your shining lunar sea.
From Sandringham to South Yarra, you're listening to Southern FM.
If you listen to the Idealists, you'd get the idea that living on the moon should be pretty easy. You know, we could make an atmosphere there and do all sorts of wonderful things, including mining the moon. Well, Christopher Wonjek, the author of the book Space Spheres, was keen to point out to the Space Association, when he spoke to it on Monday, that there are hazards on the moon.
There's some hazards to we'll have to deal with on the moon that people really don't talk about that much. It's this gravity issue that people just assume everything's fine with low gravity. So, but you know, when you think about gravity, we only have two data points. We got the Earth, and we got, you know, low Earth orbit ISS, Mir. You know, so we know Earth at 1G is good. You know, 0G bad. You know, but how do these points connect? Is it a linear relationship between the two? Or maybe you just need a little bit of gravity on the moon's what we're hoping on to have, you know, good health. Or maybe you need like a lot of gravity before, you know, you have good health. We have no idea. It would just be very surprising to me to think we could live a long time on the moon in 16% gravity. That said, living on the moon is the only way we're going to add a third data point to this. And that's very consequential for our hopes in living on Mars. The other problem is the dust, which is this horrible name for it. It's not dust. Dust is something fluffy. We should be calling this, you know, microscopic razor blades, because that's what they are. I mean, this stuff is worse than asbestos. This will cut through your lungs. This will cut through your cells. It's incredibly deadly, and it's everywhere on the moon. It's menacing. It actually levitates. It floats about 30 centimeters above the surface of the moon in these electrostatic fountains. And so you just pick it up everywhere you go. Then you bring it back into the habitat and breathe it in. It's a horrible situation. In fact, the last man to work to date to walk on the moon, Eugene Cernan, said, you know, dust might be like the one thing we can't overcome on the moon. It's just so menacing.
That song we played by the Chromatics mentioned living in lava tubes. Christopher Wonjick has some ideas about that as well.
Okay, but that was a bit doom and gloom. Now some more fun, more positive things. I think the best way to get around on the moon, I would love to see more people talking about this, is in gondolas. I mean, first of all, you're above the dust, which is a great thing. But these things can fly across the moon because there's no air resistance, right? And the gravity is low. And it'd be easier to build in roads. You know, the buggies, you know, would need roads because it's a pretty tough going over the lunar surface. You've seen the Apollo images. But these things, you just need a couple poles and some cables. So this could be our major way of getting across the moon, better than roads. I think living in lava tubes would be a really neat idea. If we gravitate away from the poles where we have to worry about this incredible temperature fluctuation, one way to deal with this is to essentially live in these lava tubes, which are like caves on Earth. You know how caves have kind of a constant but kind of cold temperature? It would be pretty cold in these, of course, minus 20 Celsius, but that's very manageable because it's constant. And some of these things are massive. They're like the size of a stadium. And you just have to seal it over and you got your ready-made habitat. And maybe you could come, you would have to live down there most of the time, but 2 weeks of the month in the dawn and the dusk, you could get out and do your activities and then get back in there and shelter in place, so to speak, and do some other kinds of work. But that would be the easiest in many ways to live outside of the polar region. And I think that lunar hotels are definitely in our future. It's really just a matter of the ticket price. If we can get ticket prices, a rocket price down to $500,000, incredibly expensive, of course, but maybe $100,000, this would be the trip of a lifetime. You know, I think there will be a major market for this, people saving up to have a couple weeks on the moon. And that would be a lot of fun. You know, Baron Hilton thought of this in 1967. Some people called him visionary. Some people called him naive. Maybe a bit of the latter. He had kind of a perverse sense of what Saturn would look like looking out at the window of the bar. I don't think it's going to be that big, Saturn. But unless he was thinking along these lines, and it's really, you could have really a lot of fun. You can imagine in a pressurized resort, in low gravity, you could be doing flips. You could throw your friend across the room. I mean, you would have incredible strength and it would just be a lot of fun for a couple weeks and then come back. I think that's definitely in our future. But, you know, this idea of cities on the moon, I just don't see how this can happen. You know, it goes back to the economic and emotional motivation. You have thousands of people working on the moon like they do in Antarctica, if the mining operations can go. But why would you live there permanently in this kind of gray, stark environment where you're always indoors, can't bring the kids along because they can't possibly grow up in 16% gravity? I just don't see how cities can happen. Maybe you have ideas, but there's that we just because we can do it doesn't mean people are going to migrate there in the tens of thousands to live in such an environment. Again, a bit like being on top of Mount Everest, regardless of the view.
If you were on the lunar near side, that's the side we see from Earth, you would see the Earth somewhere in the sky, depending how high up, depending on where you are on the moon, and it would, over the period of a month, would move a little bit in the sky, but not a great deal, by about 10 degrees or so, and the Earth would look four times bigger in the sky than our moon does from the Earth. If you're on the lunar far side, you'd never see the Earth because, it's on the other side. Well, someone at the Space Association meeting asked Christopher about the view of the Earth from the moon.
So I'm going to bring us back to Earth now from the perspective of the moon, which is a neat perspective because when you live on the moon, you can always see Earth. And that's rather comforting. And no immigrant has ever had that experience, really. You know, the colonists in Australia and the Americas, they couldn't look back to see Europe or England. You know, you wouldn't be able to see the motherland. But anyone going to the moon would always be able to go back and see the motherland. But what's really cool, perhaps from the Australian point of view, is that if you're on the South Pole of the moon, where it's where we're going to be, and you look back at the Earth, guess what's at the top of the world? Australia will be at the top of the world when you look back. And maybe like many of you think it already is.
Well, that was Christopher Wonjick on What We'd See. And when the people came to Australia from Europe, yeah, you couldn't look back and see home. Well, now, Peter Owood is going to describe the book that Christopher Wonjick has written, and he has a surprise for us.
Spacefarers is the book that Chris has written, and as I say, I'd urge anyone of the interest in this subject to go out and get a copy because it's fantastic. It's very easy to read, and it's got a nice level of detail that us space-interested/geeks are into, but it's also not heavy and overbearing and strings of calculations and chemical formulas that you just get lost. So it's a really nice balance between those two. All right, and then we do have one more giveaway for it, and that's not tonight. As people may or may not know, the Space Association run a weekly radio program called The Space Show. It's on 88.3 Southern FM here in Melbourne. It also, if you go to southernfm.com.au, you can listen to it online. Andrew Rennie is the presenter and producer of that show, and he is going to be giving away a copy of the book this coming Wednesday. I'm not sure what time it will be, but just make sure you listen in and get ready to dial the number that Andrew will give you on the night. And so we have one copy to give away on Andrew's radio show.
So once again, the book is called Spacefarers. It's a book by Christopher Wonjick, who we've been listening to. It's 347 easy-to-read pages, and he explains how humans will settle the Moon, Mars, and beyond. And Christopher's going to be back on the future program talking about the Mars and beyond part. And the book is supported by 22 pages of references and a detailed index, and it's published this year by Harvard University Press, and it is widely available here in Australia. You can get it from the Book Depository, Dimmicks, Readings, Booktopia, and elsewhere. And there's also an ebook version, and the Audible has an audiobook version of it. Now, this book, Spacefarers by Christopher Wonjick, is not to be confused with the Michael Neufeld's 2013 book of the same name. Now, at the beginning of the show, I gave you a number. Well, that number is a telephone number. It's a telephone number for Southern FM. So, that number, 90886466. I'll say that again later. And when you get the answer, then press 1 to bring it through to the studio and me. Now, we have one copy to mail out to any listener within Australia. But don't telephone until the music starts. I'm going to play some music. Now, if you ring up before then, I'll just hang up on you. Now, the book is donated courtesy of the publisher, Harvard University Press, and the postage is donated by the Space Association of Australia, which is the presenter of the space show here on Southern FM. So, that number again, 90886466, and then when it answers, select option 1 to get through to me. And I'll take the prize, will go to the third caller through. So once again, 90886466, then select option 1. And I'm going to start playing the music now.
If I were to say, my fellow citizens, that we shall send to the moon 240,000 miles away from the control station in Houston a giant rocket more than 300 feet tall, and then return it safely to Earth, re-entering the atmosphere at speeds of over 25,000 miles per hour, causing heat about half that on the temperature of the sun, almost as hot as it is here today, and do all this, and do all this, and do it right, and do it first.
You can dial in now if you want to claim that book prize. Time is running out to call 90886466, and then when you get to the message service, 1. Music we're listening to is called Last Man on the Moon, as by Joe White, and there's still a chance to win that book, but less than 2 minutes to go. We do have a winner for the book, and it's time for us to sign off. This is Andrew Rennie with The Space Show. Next week, Cosmos. Yes, 40 years since Carl Sagan's Cosmos.